Okay, folks, we're going to get started. Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm Dan Rundy. I hold the Schreier Chair here at CSIS. I think we're going to have a very interesting discussion this morning. I'm sure you're all here for the brownies and the coffee. I suspect that's not what brings you here. I think what brings you here is a very courageous and interesting report that's come out by UNDP. We're going to have one of the authors of the report speaking, and then we're going to have two distinguished representatives, one from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Lionel Johnson, and also Andrew Buckle, who is a Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury who covers the Middle East, as respondents and folks providing commentary and additional context. I think one of the things that in official Washington, I think one of the things that we miss is the power of the United Nations to deliver messages to folks who aren't going to hear it from us, aren't going to hear it from the United States. And so I think there have been a number of times where this has happened, where the United Nations has changed the world. One of those instances was the Human Development Report, and that's been something that governments look to and development practitioners look to, and has become a real milestone in how people think about how to make the world a better place. I think another that has been referenced on many occasions by a wide spectrum of political leaders in this country is the Arab Human Development Report. The first one really, in my mind, changed the world and changed how we think about some of the challenges in the Arab world. I also think the Growing Inclusive Markets Report, which came out a couple years ago from UNDP, was also another major report that the UN system did that made it safe for folks who might otherwise not want to hear it from the United States, might not want to hear it from the World Bank, might not want to hear it from the IMF, that certain sorts of messages could become more accepted by sort of a broader set of stakeholders who, like I said, may not trust certain messengers. So the UNDP and the United Nations are trusted messengers and often more trusted in certain contexts than we are, and oftentimes represents in broad derivative form something of, I will say it this way, and I'll be a little bit controversial and just say I believe it represents oftentimes a broad interest that is in alignment with the United States. And so I think it represents it. And so I think it's one of the reasons why we get a lot of benefit out of the United Nations, and we were one of the architects of starting it, and one of the reasons why that it's continued to be such a success in many ways. And I think one of the areas where it is a success is in incredible thought leadership. And so I think what we're going to be talking about around the Arab Development Challenge Report of 2011 is a particularly courageous report that, as we were talking about before the panel, what we were saying was that this probably would not have – you couldn't have published this report before the so-called Arab Spring. Without further ado, I'm going to hand the floor over to my distinguished panelists, and then we'll open it up for a conversation with what I know is a very informed and thoughtful group here in the audience. So I'm going to turn it over first to Mohammed Pornick, one of the co-authors of the report. Mohammed, over to you.
Thank you very much for hosting this event. This report came out earlier this year, but in a way, I think in terms of its utility, I think it has a longer life cycle because the changes that have happened since then show that clearly the problem is not simply one of political transition, is not simply one of getting rid of a dictator and everything will be fine. No, that's not the real issue. What the report talks, it starts as a starting point from what have been the demands of the Arab Street. It's very clear. Bread, social justice, and freedom. So it's not just freedom, and it's not, and it wasn't just jobs that they wanted. They wanted jobs with dignity. One of the slogans was that we don't want to have to know somebody before we get a job. It's not. And the problem is that now there is this dominant idea that somehow the political transition, the fact that Mubarak has left the scene, changes things. It doesn't. It's only the beginning of a process. Why is it the beginning of a process? Because the problem was not simply political exclusion. The problem was a combination of political and economic exclusion. Therefore, unless we address both, there's no way that we can succeed. And If you don't address both, there is a real danger of re-emergence of old habits. And unfortunately, we see some of that happening in both Tunisia and Egypt that are worrying in terms of current events. Now, what is the basic problem? The basic problem is that the relationship between the state, the market, and citizens is malformed. It does not operate the way it should do. The market does not respond to the demands of consumers for good quality products and does not provide workers with decent jobs. The state does not respond to what people need. The other way around, it's the citizens who are dependent on the state and on the market. Now, what are some of the major facets or drivers of this, what we call an exclusionary development process? And actually, this, I must mention, this report started out by being a very economistic report. But as we moved along, and as the events of late 2010, early 2011 unfolded, we had to change tack. We absolutely had to turn it into a complete multidisciplinary approach, bringing in political scientists and economists and sociologists together to look at the whole beast rather than looking at only certain aspects of the beast. When you look at that, you see that you have mutually reinforcing processes where the state is not performing in terms of the market is not performing because it's only politically connected businesses who can operate in the market. People have their rights taken away from them, even rights to use common property, common resources. You have concentration of assets to an incredible extent. And a lot of this is below the radar screen, which is why I still remember on the 25th of January 2011 having to suddenly pull off from our website all the glory we had given to Tunisia for its HDR, because the figures do show something, but figures also mask a lot of things. And this is why we have to be very careful when we use figures, and especially, I mean, those around the table who are economists. I mean, unfortunately, we are trained to use figures, but figures only go so far. You need to dig underneath, and this is one of the things we try to do. This is why you have to bring the two sides. I mean, citizens are not, ordinarily are not involved in the political processes. Particular groups, and you can choose the country, and you will find in some countries it's even majorities who are excluded from participation. But every single country has one or other group, sometimes multiple groups, that are excluded from access to power. And the neglect of interior regions is throughout the region. So despite the fact that people talk about huge diversity in the region, and there is diversity definitely in terms of levels of income and HDI, but the underlying reality of life is very similar throughout the region, and that's what helps you understand what's happening. And so what you have is, yes, you definitely have growth, but it comes with inequality, but an inequality that, unfortunately, we cannot measure because of problems with our measurement tools. We can discuss that later. There's huge mismanagement of resources. These countries are rich. For example, in the case of Yemen, the country is engaged in collective suicide. I mean, once you run out of water, there's no life, and the country is running out of water. You have exclusive governance, not only non-inclusive, and we chose the term deliberately, governance which expressly excludes everybody other than a particular group from involvement. You have subnational disparities again. Choose any country you like. We can see it. And you have unemployment and indecent work. And you have very different differential treatment for different groups. So even in countries that are better off, you have different differential treatment. Now, one of the key challenges that everybody has talked about is employment. We have data about it in the report, but it's not really, I mean, and we shouldn't get bogged down in terms of the rates, whether the rates have gone down or up, and what is, because anyway, the measurement of employment in countries where you do not have effective unemployment insurance schemes, you don't have places where people can sign up to if they're looking for a job, it's a bit of an academic exercise anyway. But definitely you have large numbers of young people who are increasingly educated, who in an earlier era would have been employed by the state, who are going without jobs. And that is not sustainable. And those were the people who were in the street. And they will continue to be in the street until something happens for them. You have huge rural-urban disparities. You go out of, take the case of Sudan. I mean, you leave Khartoum, you go out of Khartoum 20 kilometers, there's no sign of anything modern. And you can take your pick in terms of countries. Again, this is not sustainable. You keep emptying the rural areas and everybody wants to come to urban areas. You have rising inequality, but the key problem is that this inequality is not noticeable when you use indicators like the Gini coefficient. The Gini coefficient for the Arab region looks very good, deceptively good. But the reality is that there's huge disparities, but our calculations fail to take into account the top earners, because when we go out and do our surveys, those are typically the ones who don't participate. And also we miss out the bottom, those without any fixed place of residence. So, and the way we checked that was we looked at what is the total consumption that you get from household budget surveys and the total consumption you get from looking at GDP accounts. In Egypt, the difference is a ratio of 1-3. So 2/3 of the consumption that shows up in GDP, you're not capturing in your consumption surveys. Then, of course, if you're only capturing 1/3 of the consumption, you're going to hugely underestimate the level of disparities. And anyway, even that disparity is only with respect to consumption. It does not look at access to assets where the disparities are huge. You also have a major challenge in terms of managing environment and food security. I mean, these countries are engaging in destructive practices with use of the natural resources that are heavily energy dependent, heavily water dependent, in a region that is the most water scarce region in the world. And so that you even engage in export of virtual water by the kind of agriculture produce that they have. And you use food subsidies to subsidize foreign farmers rather than your own farmers and provide a varied diet. But there's no way that this whole litany of economic problems could have gone on without governance failures. I mean, someone somewhere would have done something about it. So it's really the problem that at the bottom, at the end of it, you have institutions of the executive branch that are captured by particular groups, and then one group can leave, another group takes their place. It's not a question of negotiation. You have corrosive constituencies that work on social aid. I mean, many of these countries used to have meaningfully operating labor unions, employers' associations. All those were politically infiltrated, filled with people who were associated with the regime, and therefore ordinary businessmen were prevented from growing up, growing their businesses, and labor unions were not able. So you had no way to negotiate when there was an issue on which there were some losers and gainers. And then all of these things pile up. I mean, there's one interesting anecdote. In Sana'a in Yemen, there is a half-finished building which belongs to some businessman who grew too big for his size. He was not allowed because the business community in Yemen has to be controlled by five families. And those are the five who win all contracts, and so that's the reality of life. You have also at the local level, there's no accountability between local government and citizens. Because local government is more seen as a way to pass down the functions of the state to local level, exactly the opposite of the principle of subsidiarity. And you have non-functioning judicial systems and no effective redress mechanisms. You do not have properly functioning legal aid mechanisms. The lawyers' associations are either completely politicized or don't exist. So again, no way to peacefully resolve. Now, from our analysis, clearly this, what we're calling the exclusionary rentier state model, has run its course. And the reason why it has run its course is because it's no longer able to buy social peace. Now, one country that shall remain unnamed, but people know what I'm talking about, after Arab Spring spent billions of dollars to buy social peace. But not every single country can do that. And even that has its limit. So clearly, there is only so much you can do in terms of buying social peace with money. We need to move to a different structure which actually puts the citizen at the center of the universe. And this is where, of course, take a cue from Dan, is where UN's formative role comes in. I mean, we do stand for the centrality of the human being. And the solution from our perspective is to move to a system where it's the citizen that becomes the dominant circle. And both the state and market respond to the citizen and are controlled by the citizen. Now, what are some of the most important requirements for this change to happen? And then, once you look at this, we can see why the road is going to be long and why a lot of the things that we see at present could have been expected. You need a new development vision. You need a new social contract. I mean, the critical thing, you need a new social contract of mutual accountability. The state, in a post-transition setting, cannot remain the dominant force and buy social peace by just aligning with certain groups. There has to be an inclusive political system. The state does not have to disappear. The state has to become capable and accountable. The problem is not to get a smaller state, but to get a better state. And again, I know there are differences of opinion in terms of the size of the state, but what is important is that even though the size of the state in terms of share in GDP is quite high in most countries in the Middle East, it does not mean that the state is actually using that in an active and developmental sense. They're using that in a very negative form in order to undermine their sense of accountability to the citizen. So it's not a question of simply getting it smaller, but it's getting a better state, getting a state that actually sets the rules, enforces the rules, provides the necessary infrastructure. We definitely need a competitive and transparent market. What we have in most countries in the region, and most of them have gone through the standard economic liberalization policies, but they don't have a competitive market. A competitive market is a market where there are no major barriers to entry. If you're not politically well connected, if your cousin isn't related to the first lady in Tunisia, there's no way you can start a business. I remember last time I visited Tunisia before Ben Ali left, people are saying even to start a nursery, somebody from the royal family had to be associated. So I mean, what kind of a business sector is this? Of course, the structure of the economy also has to change. I mean, you don't simply change the political structure, but also the structure of the economy has to change. You have to develop a productive economy that moves away from rent-based activities and trading, which is the main thing. I mean, again, I looked at, for example, the composition of bank credit in a number of countries, and you find that 95% of it is going for trading and for short-term credit. I mean, if you are a businessman and you need to borrow money for a five-year project, your chances of getting it are almost zero. How can you operate? There's no use of taxation to deal with the high level of inequality and also to fund the provision of social services, the provision of badly needed social services. In addition, the quality of social services has declined over the years, and we see that, I mean, a good measure of that is out-of-pocket expenditures on health, which have risen in most countries over time. Now, at the macroeconomic level as well, we believe the situation has become so dire that there absolutely has to be some protection offered to locally produced products to allow them to operate, because, again, many of these countries suffer from a Dutch disease problem with overvalued exchange rates that cause them problems. Financial intermediation is a major problem. I mean, banks are not performing their function in terms of channeling resources to those who need them. Public procurement procedures are used to favor politically connected big businesses as opposed to really generating jobs for the local economy. And, again, I know this is not going to be particularly popular, but in the Arab region, we've tried to look at the correlation between budget deficits and inflation, and we didn't find any, because most of the inflation in this region is cost push. Therefore, there is the possibility of increasing the deficit responsibly to use it for dealing with the infrastructural bottlenecks without causing inflation. And again, I mean, don't forget that the problems in Tunisia started in Sidi Bouzid, which is a neglected region. So you absolutely have to deal with the question of balancing subnational development. And for that, there has to be active engagement. You cannot just depend on the automatic operation of the market to do that, because the automatic operation of the market causes people to go to poles that already exist. If I want to invest and there's already a number of industries set up, factories set up in this location, it makes sense for me to go and set up my factory also in the same location. But then what happens to other areas? So there has to be a conscious policy to try and really deal with this major problem of regional disparities as well. And the environment, I mean, things that I mentioned the case of Yemen, because these countries are also on borrowed time. I mean, it's the most water-scarce region in the world, so you absolutely have to do something. And on fuel subsidies as well. I mean, Saudi Arabia, with the production of 10 million barrels of oil, if they continue at the current pace, I believe in 20 years or 25 years, they'll have no oil to export. So absolutely the current structure of the growth process is not sustainable, and it has to be revised. On the governance front, there are certain immediate things that have to be done that people have tried to do, and we see some of the problems that have already emerged because there's lack of confidence in them. I mean, there has to be credible elections if people don't feel that the system allows them to participate. The new constitutions have to be inclusive. I mean, if particular groups feel that their rights are being trampled upon, that won't work. The budgeting process has to become open and transparent. And this is not difficult at all. But politically, it has been resisted. I was part of a donor group in Yemen that goes back to late 2005. And the only thing we wanted from Ali Abdullah Saleh's government was to simply publish who wins public contracts. They said, no, we have to do things properly. We have to change the procurement laws, systems, rules, which meant 5 more years of their cronies getting all the contracts. So that these things that can be done, I'm finished, can be done very, very quickly. And there also has to be some degree of attention to transitional justice. And people who feel that they've been wronged, they have to sense that there is something happening. Otherwise, you'll lose them. In terms of the longer term, of course, in countries where you don't have a good tradition of functioning legislative systems, those need to be built up. And those are some of the things that, for example, definitely I think the U.S. experience can be very helpful in the way the congressional committees work, the way there is some backup so that legislators can decide based on their own information. They don't always have to rely on what is provided to them. Judiciary, again, all these institutions really have to build up from scratch. And the key thing is also institutions to manage social conflict. Those are almost non-existent. And unless and until we have those, you will have continuous reappearance of old problems. And given the fact that the region overall is very rich, I feel that regional integration on economic issues is also a clear deal. I mean, the problem is that the region has focused too much on political integration, and that hasn't gone very far. I mean, it's always been in terms of being anti-something, but that doesn't get you very far. That there has to be some attention to improving the flow of intra-Arab trade, these things. I mean, it's much easier for you to import an item from a faraway place than from next door because of simply trade facilitation. Very simple things that can be done to improve things. Having said that, despite the fact that there are many common traits between countries, there's definitely no one size fits all. And depending on the particular case, one has to see what is the best route to go in either country. Thank you. I'm sorry.
No, thank you, Mohammed. It's a lot of material. I think it's I've always found that the UN has really excellent diagnoses. I'm not sure I'd agree with with all of the suggestions in terms of the reforms. I'd agree with a lot of them, but not all of them. But I do think what's particularly courageous about this report is using statements like that this is a exclusive governance, exclusionary rentier state. I mean, those are fighting words, for a UN report. So I think, your diagnosis is courageous and spot on. And I think there's a lot in the recommendations that I think we're going to get a warm reception. Some of them I'm not in agreement with, but I think you'll hear from our panelists to hear what they have to say both about the report, but also providing their perspective on the region. So I'm going to hand the floor over to Lionel Johnson from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you very much to CSIS for hosting this program and for UNDP for including me. And Mohammed, congratulations to you and your team for the work that you have obviously put into this report. And I actually, on a personal as well as a professional level, agree with many of your findings and your comments that you've made this morning. I've been in this role at the Chamber of Commerce for just about 21 months. I started on February 7th, 2011. The week after Ben Ali fell, and the week of Mubarak's resignation, and it has not been boring since. And I think what we have seen over these last 20 or so months has been a dramatic transformation of a region, but as societies. And I think that one of the great challenges that we have had at the Chamber is helping to contribute to a realization and appreciation of the breadth of this change here in the United States, among the American people, among businesses who have long been engaged in the region, some for 100 years, in the case of one in Egypt that comes to mind. But also to remind everyone that this region has many, many countries and traditions and societies, and the transitions underway are unique. They are national in character and scope, and that the region is not a monolith. And so each of our companies that have been engaged there have had to make assessments about their businesses over the past 20 months, But I can tell you this, if you look at the largest market in the area in which I work, Egypt, I've been encouraged by a number of things, even in spite of the events of the last couple of months. That is that the Arab Spring, or the transition, if you will, that was basically responsible for the transition to a new government after Mubarak left power, was only the first phase of it. And what's playing out now in the streets, by virtue of a democratic process being established, it's not democracy, but it's a process of establishing more accountable governance. And it's very interesting to watch that framework still in construction, having to guide a discussion between two halves of society. And it is it's unfortunate that it's become violent in the last few days. But I am one who looks at this with a long-term perspective, as do most of our companies who are engaged not only in Egypt but throughout the region, that these are transitions that have been long in coming. And for too long, too many of the region's peoples have been excluded from economic prosperity and growth and social opportunity. Women have not been included in the walks of life of many of these societies. And that it was just a situation that was just having to happen. But for our companies, I will say that in the case of Egypt, again, not one U.S. company has pulled out of Egypt during my tenure, and that's very significant. We took to Egypt in September the largest business delegation that we've ever taken to the Middle East region, and only the second in the history, second largest in the history of the Chamber of Commerce in 100 years. We took 120 delegates to Egypt for 3 days of meetings with the entire range of Egyptian government officials, including 2.5 hours with President Morsi. And I can tell you that we were all very impressed by, first of all, not only the rhetoric, an appreciation for the role of the private sector, both the indigenous private sector in Egypt, but also the role of the international private sector, and particularly the United States, in helping to move the country forward, and that recognition that private sector-led growth is going to be the only possibility for them to get out of the current fiscal situation that they are in, and the need to get back onto a path of economic growth that's more inclusive and that begins to address the really pressing developmental needs of the country. Since that time, I will say, you know, we have been concerned about developments in Egypt. I have, over the last few months, spent a lot of time developing relationships with the Muslim Brotherhood. It's not up until, you know, several months ago, it was officially U.S. policy in Cairo not to even speak to the Muslim Brotherhood. So, you know, it was not unusual that I raised a few eyebrows in February when I hosted a parliamentary delegation from the party at the chamber. But to engage a wide range of Egyptians, including those that we have known for many years, but the new crowd, was imperative to understanding what's happening there. I spent an hour earlier this week with the National Security Advisor to President Morsi and his Chief Economic Advisor, who were here in Washington making the rounds. I really spoke to them about the transformation that's taking place right now and the importance of a credibly conducted constitutional process. They are very committed to, I believe, having this constitution ratified on the 15th, but it is a document that I don't believe is perfect. No constitution is, but there are several things in it that I think are cause for concern, particularly what regards the rights of women. Rolls back several areas of progress that I think are very concerning for us as Westerners, but even for companies. It throws into question the commitment to more inclusive governance for this country. But in the final analysis, in Egypt, as across the region, these are transitions that have to be fundamentally managed by the people of the countries. And our companies are very, very committed to the long-term development and participation in not only Egypt, but across the region. If you step back and we look at what is happening, there are many, many challenges, developmental challenges, political and social. But I agree, Mohammed, that the constant in all of these transitions has been the need for greater economic and social inclusion and empowerment. and private sector is the one element of all of these societies that has the potential to deliver on the promise of democracy. And that, I think, is what our mission is. Through three visits to Egypt this week, this year, to Jordan, to Morocco, and twice to Israel, Saudi Arabia. I leave tonight for Bahrain and Kuwait and Turkey. Throughout the region, you know, our program has developed over the past 20 months. It's actually doubled in size in terms of geography and scope and the programming that we're doing. The only thing that hasn't doubled is my staff, to my chagrin. But we are looking at the region as one of tremendous opportunity for U.S. companies to partner with the private sectors of these countries to really be partners for development. And if we look at, you talk about Saudi Arabia and the sustainability of their oil production, particularly for exports, I agree with you, it's not sustainable. But the Saudis, where I was just a few weeks meeting with them in Riyadh, recognized the importance of diversifying their energy sector. So we had 20 delegates from U.S. nuclear companies and solar companies that spent 2 days in Riyadh with serious intention to have U.S. companies play a part in the Saudi government's commitment to roughly $500 billion of investment in energy diversification over the next 5 years. So there are many, many opportunities for the private sector to play a positive role. And, you know, we look forward to continuing to work with our government here, with our American Chambers of Commerce represented in each one of the markets in which we're engaged, our chamber partner in the Center for International Private Enterprise works throughout the region and has for many, many years in providing technical assistance and training to strengthen the enabling environment for private sector development. And so that work is going to continue. So while these are challenging times, and while some of the region is cause for serious concern and dismay, and particularly where violence ensues, there are serious pockets of opportunity, and I think we have to just keep a long-term perspective.
Thank you, Lionel. Andrew, the floor is yours.
Thanks. Before I start, I see two people standing in the back, and there's two empty chairs way up here if you guys are interested. I want to thank Daniel and CSIS for hosting this and hosting me, and again, like Lionel, congratulate Muhammad and his team on an excellent report from UNDP. I think from our perspective at Treasury and within the U.S. government, I think many of the themes that UNDP has highlighted today are issues that we've been focused on over the last almost 2 years, and issues that we're struggling to try to figure out ways that we can be most effective in trying to address. In particular, I think from an economic standpoint, we recognize that many of the development challenges that Mohammed talked about are really at the heart of some of the political change that's going on. And that the political change won't work out well unless these economic and development challenges are being addressed at the same time. And this importantly includes the issues of inclusive growth and job creation, which gets at, as Mohammed said, sort of the next layer is the issues of the elites and the sort of corruption that has been involved in the past, and really generating more competition within these economies in order to promote more widespread income growth and as well as productivity growth. Now, at Treasury, we've focused on, I would say, two overarching themes, and then I'll talk about some of the tools that we've had, particularly multilateral tools, to try to help these countries. First task is basic preserving macroeconomic stabilization. Several of these countries, you know, have lost a lot of their foreign exchange reserves. They are struggling to finance their budget deficits. It obviously would not be conducive to a smooth political transition or economic growth if these countries face some sort of financing crisis. So providing basic balance of payments finance, fiscal financing, helping these countries address some of the resource mismanagement, as Mohammed described, which includes the large spending on subsidies. Some of those issues need to be tackled in the near term. Second is laying the groundwork for these economies to set the stage for more inclusive growth, expanding the opportunities for those that have been left behind. And again, this comes back, from our perspective, mainly to increasing competition in these economies. We also recognize, I think, that addressing these issues at a policy level needs to be done based on homegrown country plans. Each country has somewhat different challenges. There's some common themes, but each country is quite a bit different in how you would want to sequence, how you would want to deal with the political economy of different issues. So we recognize the importance of building sort of civil society and inclusive, more inclusive ways for these countries to come up with the policies that they can implement themselves. This gets at transparency issues, publication of budgets, other things that the UNDP report has highlighted. Now, the tools that we've had in the U.S. government and that we focus on at Treasury, there's a long set of bilateral tools, and then there's a set of multilateral tools. And I won't spend much time on the bilateral. I'll just tick off some of them. Helping on the stabilization front includes loan guarantees, which we did one for Tunisia this summer, which was very important. We have cash transfer programs that we've done for Tunisia and Jordan. Turning to the more longer-term development, there's, of course, AID programs in a lot of these countries. There's creation of new enterprise funds. There's a series of ways to help the private sector through OPIC or EXIM or helping the chamber to the extent that we can and that they want us to facilitate business promotion missions or highlight private sector role. And I won't spend a lot of time on that, but let me just say that, you know, I think we all recognize what Lionel and the chamber and the private sector is doing is extremely important, and Lionel described that well. Then on the multilateral side, let me just spend a couple minutes here. As some of you probably know, last year, the French, as the Arab Springs were going on, the French were the chairs of the G8, and they kicked off something called the Deauville Partnership at the summit in Deauville. Deauville Partnership includes all the G8 countries. It includes the transition countries, so-called transition countries, Tunisia, Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, and now Yemen. It also includes the major Gulf countries as well as Turkey, and it includes, from the finance side, all of the relevant international financial institutions, including the IMF, World Bank, African Bank, EBRD, as well as regional ones like the Islamic Development Bank, Arab Monetary Fund, et cetera. In the U.S., were the G8 hosts this year, so we were the chair of this process. And there's three broad tracks in this partnership. One is in the finance channel, led by finance ministries. Secretary Geithner hosted two meetings of finance ministers this year under this partnership. There's a governance channel that's led by the State Department, and Secretary Clinton hosted a meeting up in New York this year. And then there's a trade and investment channel that's led by the White House and USTR, and they've had a number of meetings as well this year. In the finance channel, again, coming back to the two goals of preserving macroeconomic stability and setting the stage for longer-term, more inclusive growth and development. On the stabilization side, the IMF has played an important role in a number of countries, and I would highlight that the IMF has a number of different tools, and it's using its tools quite flexibly depending on the circumstances at hand. So, for example, Morocco has an agreement with the IMF called a precautionary liquidity line, where Morocco doesn't actually draw on the money unless it needs it, because Morocco's situation is reasonably strong, but it's a nice backstop just in case. Yemen had what was called a rapid credit facility from the IMF, which is a smaller amount of money, basically short-term support based on in a more transitional period, given that Yemen is still sort of struggling on the political side. Jordan has a more traditional standby agreement because it faces more traditional balance of payments pressures. And as you've seen in the news, Egypt is coming close to reaching agreement with the IMF on a more traditional standby as well. Also, in this G8 context, we had what we call a capital markets initiative, which is to try to help these countries, both the public sector and private sectors, gain access to capital markets. This includes the loan guarantee that the United States government did with Tunisia earlier this year, which allowed Tunisia to borrow almost $500 million at a very low interest rate of less than 2% over 7 years, thanks to a U.S. government guarantee. There's also a number of work done by the different international financial institutions to provide additional credit enhancements both to the public sector and private sector, as well as start work on developing domestic capital markets in these countries. On the more longer-term development side and setting the stage for inclusive growth, there have also been a number of advancements over the last 2 years. Perhaps the most important is the expansion of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development to the region. The EBRD, as most of you probably know, was created after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Soviet Union, created to help develop the private sectors in the former socialist communist regimes of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. So the EBRD has been active there for 20 years with a strictly private sector focused, providing technical assistance as well as financing for private sector projects. And as described in the UNDP report, this model seems quite relevant to this region as well, where you're turning from systems that have been in some ways dominated by the government or at least government-connected enterprises to a model where you want more growth of small, medium enterprises, more purely private sector development. So the EBRD just this year has approved its expansion to a number of countries bordering the Mediterranean, and just in the last 2 months has started approving its first projects in Tunisia, in Morocco, in Jordan, and it will approve some in Egypt very soon. So we think this is can be quite helpful. Other international financial institutions, the World Bank and the African Bank, also active in the Arab Spring countries, in particular, I would say, in Tunisia, where the banks have provided budget support operations in support of the government's efforts to become more transparent, to strengthen its social safety nets, to address regional disparities. And these banks are also in close contact with the Egyptian government, the Jordanian government, and others on similar operations. Finally, one other initiative that was launched this year under this Deauville partnership is something called the Transition Fund, which is a new pool of money. Right now, it's got pledges of $165 million to help these countries with improving governance and sort of their business operations. It's a fund that will provide technical assistance and capacity building in conjunction with these countries and with one of the international financial institutions it will be set up over a long-term period, so it'll be in operation for the next several years. Just next week in Jordan, we will formally kick off this transition fund and approve, hopefully approve the first couple of projects under its rubric. Since I think we're probably running a little bit long, let me end there and let Daniel lead us for further.
Thank you, Andrew. I think it's clear there are major challenges in the region. I think that this report has certainly laid out a very clear and courageous diagnosis, and I think that there are ways in which the United States can respond to this, both multilaterally and bilaterally, and obviously we have a contribution to make in trying to and to help make this to solve some of these challenges, but often it's going to lie in the hands of the societies themselves and in the of the leadership of those societies is the primary driver of whether or not change is going to happen. I'm going to open it up for comments. There are a lot of thoughtful people here in the room, and I'd like to if I don't see hands from them, I'm going to call on them. So, be prepared. Let me get a couple more questions because I think that is a very important question, and I'm going to ask some of the panelists to respond to that. Let me get some other comments. The gentleman back there, if you could just identify yourself. And yes, sir. I'm going to have the panelists respond to this set of questions, and then we're going to get to my friends. Mohammed, why don't you? I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to respond first to the gentleman from Saudi Arabia, if you could speak to that because I think that's that is one of the elephants in the room.
Well, the things that.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, I mean, the thing is that, the region has actually survived based on this externally. I remember there was an article that I read many, many years ago, maybe in the late 60s, talking about how the Arab regimes used Israel as a way of justifying their oppression of their own peoples. So the thing is that it's both, I mean, both the direct support and the existence of an enemy that you can focus attention on and you can close people off by saying, oh, if you attack this, you endanger national security. That is a major problem that is difficult to address by one party alone. I mean, this is something which has to be handled in a global kind of thing. I mean, any attempts to sort of reduce tensions overall, because the things that... And now, with Israel becoming less of a bogey, you see that more and more Iran is becoming the new bogey, because you need somebody to focus attention on in order to justify what you're doing internally. So I think some kind of a broader initiative, the kind of things that UN could possibly have a role in, of course the political side, not the development, would be to really try and lessen the level of tension. And by lessening the level of tension, you make it more difficult for people to justify what they're doing. And also even it makes it more difficult for the administration here to want to not pay attention to human rights abuses, because you can ask for those constitutions to go to take second level if there is an overriding security concern. So by removing the extent of security concern, I think that would be my best recommendation. And that's not exactly my field. But
could other panelists want to answer some of the questions that are put out there, or in particular the gentleman from Saudi Arabia?
I'll skip the question from the gentleman from Saudi Arabia. Okay. I'll go right to what's more in my area, although I'm tempted to respond, but I won't. With respect to some of the major impediments that companies are finding, again, remember, each of these markets is different, with different histories and administrations and regulatory frameworks. But I would say that if you look for a couple of constants, the challenges would be probably in all of them the rule of law, the sanctity of contracts, decision-making in the midst of transition, just trying to get the people who have the power to make decisions, and are they going to be there in 3 weeks as cabinet officers or directors general in a ministry. That's a source of frustration. Transparency of regulation, you know, promulgation of regulations so that there is some predictability in the business environment. Those are some fundamentals that really go across the entire region. With respect to our private sector engagement, the question from the gentleman in the back there, that is really at the heart of what we're trying to do. Yes, we had meetings on all these missions with government officials, but the real effort is to bring U.S. companies to greater partnerships with the private sectors of all of these countries in which we've operated, and particularly in the area of small and medium-sized enterprise development, which I think really is going to be a driver of economic progress and growth over the next decade for most of these countries. In Egypt in February, we did have a major suppliers conference where we had several U.S. large multinational companies, you know, the Bechtels of the world, GE, et cetera. We had a conference in Cairo, and we expected maybe this was basically an idea of Jeff Elmholtz, the CEO of GE. We thought we'd get maybe 100 companies together. We had 650 Egyptian companies show up and really spend a day and a half with real companies to identify real opportunities. And we're replicating that in the newest of the countries in my region, which is Turkey, where we've just had the biannual Economic Policy Council meeting. And out of that, a commitment that we will at the chamber sign next Friday in Ankara, a memorandum of understanding with the U.S. chamber equivalent, the Confederation of Chambers of Commerce in Turkey, in the presence of the Prime Minister, and a real commitment over the next year in partnership, actually, with the United States government. This is where we actually do work very closely with our friends at State and Treasury and Commerce to bring Turkish and American companies together, not only for the purpose of doing business in Turkey and bilateral trade here in the United States and investment opportunities, but how we can bring certain sectors of our economy together with Turkish sectors, companies from those sectors, to support the process of development in the region. In, for instance, construction, we bring our engineering and design firms together with very sophisticated and capable Turkish construction firms and really do some serious development infrastructure work in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya. So that is really a partnership that is at the core of what we're trying to do.
I think I will pass on the question from the gentleman in Saudi Arabia, too, just to note that it's an important question, and our State Department has it well underhand. let me answer the question from the gentleman in the corner on the Capital Markets Initiative and whether it's dealing with subnational government borrowing. The answer to that is really not yet. So far, we focused on trying to help sovereigns get stronger access to capital markets, as well as private sector, including small and medium enterprises. But one of the initiatives under the capital markets group is to do studies of domestic capital market developments, and those studies are just being completed now. And so there's the potential going forward to build on those and figure out ways also to help subnational governments get better access to credit. Of course, there's complications with, you'll have to have good cooperation between sovereign and local authorities there, and that'll be different in each country. But there is the potential that we can be helpful on that.
Okay. Let me ask, I'm going to ask Gordon and my friend from DAI and the gentleman, those three. I'm going to take those three. Is there any other questions? This woman here. I'm going to take those four, okay? And then we're going to, so go ahead, Gordon, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thanks, Dan. My name is Claire Fallander. I'm from an organization called Ashoka. We support social entrepreneurs around the world. And I just wanted to bring up a lot of we've commented, or most of the panelists commented, about the importance of local solutions for many of the social problems in the region. And I wanted to discuss, I come with a certain bias because we believe in the importance of supporting entrepreneurial leaders who can find who basically are attacking social problems at a systemic level. And trying to seed that leadership within the region. And I'm curious about how, in each of the institutions you represent or organizations you represent, how do you think that the development approach or the investment approach for development could help foster more of that entrepreneurial approach that could ultimately be the partners to business and government leaders to be able to seed new policy solutions for the growing new governments in the region?
Let me take the question on agriculture and water scarcity. The question is that the problem is the kind of agriculture they engage in, not agriculture. The thing is that, for example, in Yemen, there is the Tahama project where they're producing very water-intensive crops. They should change that crop and produce something else. But the reality is that in most of these countries, you have large segments of the population who live in rural areas, who are dependent on agriculture. Now, and there's no way you can absorb them all into industry, so they have to continue. And it's really they need to move upscale, for example, specifically in the long run. I mean, we suggest that they should try to go for things like organic certified agriculture in the case of Tunisia, where they have good facilities to do that, so that they get more value and create jobs for the educated group, because agriculture does have that potential. But yes, we're not suggesting sort of large-scale schemes in agriculture, because those can have major both environmental and social implications. So, and on the question of social entrepreneurship, the whole question of entrepreneurship is very problematic in the region because of a long tradition that it's the state that it's the provident state. It's the state that provides for you, that gives you a job, and you keep your mouth shut. You don't get engaged in politics, but the state will provide you something. Now, that kind of approach over many years has killed a lot of entrepreneurship. I remember having discussions with people about what do you consider somebody who's employed. They said it's only somebody who has a contract who's employed. So, for example, for them, a major film star is unemployed because the person does not have a contract, an annual contract on which he or she draws a monthly salary. Forget the fact that the person gets $5 million for shooting one film, but no, the person is not employed. So you really have that major problem, and this is an area on which various UN development agencies have been working in many countries, trying to build up entrepreneurship amongst young people, trying to foster community-based interventions to find local solutions, working to beef up local administrations so that they can actually better plan for use of their things, engaging in conflict management across around resource issues. I mean, for example, we had a wonderful project in Sudan that dealt with how to try and bring back a harmony which had been destroyed through environmental changes between nomadic populations and settled populations. So there's a lot that is being done on the ground, but it's a battle where you move one inch, but the other side, you're being crushed by many miles because, for example, I mean, the environmental destruction that is happening is destroying a lot of the very good work that we do.
Comments from the other panelists on the other questions that are out there.
Just to be quick, just a response to the gentleman's question about the amount of leverage that we have over what's happening right now. I would say we had more leverage, or at least an opportunity to exercise leverage about 20 months ago than we do today. The failure to meet the commitments that we have made over a year and a half, not only in the economic assistance area, including debt relief for Egypt and others, has eroded our credibility. And I think in many respects, after 20 months, I've seen a turning away from the United States on the part of the young people of these countries who have been responsible for this and in many respects have responded to President Obama's Cairo speech. They've done the hard work, and now we haven't responded in the way that I think is commensurate with the role that we should be playing in the region. And that's not a criticism of anyone in the room, particularly my friend here in the Treasury Department, but we have a collective responsibility for this failure of leadership. Secondly, kinds of transitions that we're seeing, Eric, in business activity over the last 10 years, what would be different from what was happening in the last 10 years? It's moving away from, you know, the manufacturing and the more typical extractive industry type activity that you've seen through the region to more 21st century technologies in the energy sector, moving to renewables. And developing large new finds of natural gas throughout the region, creating a knowledge-based economy where the countries like Egypt need to get a better grip on their educational requirements and skills development. But there is no reason why Egypt, with its young people and given its demographics, could not be a center of innovation across 21st century industries. Thank you. I appreciate it. It's a former colleague of mine. And then finally, just sort of the kinds of projects that companies like Bechtel would be looking to. This is a region that needs very substantial infrastructure development and the connectivity between the capitals and the rest of the country. And I think in almost every place that I've been this year, this is a fundamental problem. In Egypt, obviously, it's the Upper Nile. That has been so far left behind from the rest of the country. You look like you have a point that you want to elaborate.
But that's short term. I mean, once you build up the infrastructure, what moves over it?
We got to keep.
Well, it's not short term. I mean, you build a road, that's a long term commitment and creates jobs and it creates economic connectivity. So it's not at all short term.
Andy? Thank you. Let me just answer the remaining questions from the two gentlemen down there.
I'll take social entrepreneurship.
The first gentleman talked about capacity building needs, technical assistance needs, and I think we fully agree with the premise of that point. We have been trying to address this both in bilateral channels and multilateral. Bilaterally, we at Treasury have a small technical assistance group that focuses mainly on fiscal or banking issues, working with finance ministries or central banks. So we've had somebody in Morocco, Palestine. We've had a team in Iraq. We've just sent somebody to Tunisia this summer who had to be evacuated, unfortunately, given the events there. We've been working with the Libyans for the last 9 months trying to get people placed there. But given their changes in government repeatedly, it's been hard to finalize a program with the Libyans. We've just been to Yemen to try to set up a program there. And all of these are focused on placing individuals in finance ministries or central bank to help build their capacity to do basic governance business. Also, on the multilateral side, the premise of the transition fund that I had mentioned is basically acknowledging that many of these countries do have broader needs on the technical assistance side that this transition fund, we hope, can help address. It's based on it'll be countries themselves will come up with proposals to the fund, and then the transition fund can help finance individual projects that can help build capacity in a wide variety of areas, cutting. So we have
good question.
We have $165 million pledged towards a goal of 250. Yes, I'm getting there. Patience. Our first meeting is next week. We expect that this month there'll be between $30 and $40 million in the fund ready to disperse, and it's a multi-year fund, so it's planned over a three-year horizon. So having $40 million in the first month, over $165 million pledged over 3 years, is actually not terribly bad. Let me get to your questions now, your difficult question, which is a difficult question. So let me start by saying, from the U.S. chairing the G8 this year, I think we wanted to avoid raising too many expectations and making too many promises about that we wouldn't be able to keep. So we, did not launch a huge G8 fundraising effort given, fiscal issues in our country, fiscal issues in Europe. So we've tried to come up with more specific practical issues that can actually help address some of these challenges that we've been talking about for the last hour and a half. On a multilateral basis, we have things like the EBRD expansion. We don't expect that it will require recapitalization of the EBRD. We're told that they can generate internal resources to cover very significant amounts of lending.
I believe that.
Daniel believes that. So
I approve. Okay.
All right. Check. We've also, one innovative thing about the partnership this year was bringing in the Arab financial institutions, which are now working much more closely with the IMF and the World Bank and the African Bank. And in fact, the Islamic Development Bank is now the chair of the coordination platform that they are working on. This doesn't bring in, this doesn't necessarily add new money, but it certainly makes the money from all of these institutions much more effective as they talk to each other and come with a common position. You mentioned that Congress hasn't funded our request in FY13 yet. Just so other people know, the administration has requested $770 million for what's called the Middle East North Africa Incentive Fund. As part of that request, we're asking for authorization to do loan guarantees, which several countries in the region are interested in. And as has been noted, Congress hasn't acted on that request yet. There's been some movement in the Senate, which has been helpful, and less movement in the House, shall we say. Obviously, this is something that the administration cares deeply about. In particular, our State Department and White House colleagues are working very closely with folks on the Hill, as are Treasury and other agencies, AID. So we are very hopeful that that the MENA Incentive Fund will be financed in the end. It certainly would be helpful if it was already there and we could start to act on the funds and develop programs based on it. Let me add one other thing, which is, in the G8 context, I described mainly what was going on in the finance ministry channel, since that's what I've been working on. But there's a variety of other things that were going on in the other channels, and I don't want to downplay their importance. So the State Department and the White House had a number of initiatives under their channels. Let me just highlight one, which was an asset recovery initiative where we worked with the countries in transition as well as the G8 and the Gulf to describe how these countries like Tunisia that wants to go and find Ben Ali assets that are held abroad, how they actually go about and do that. Who in France, who in the United States Justice Department do they need to go to, and what are the mechanisms and what's the process? And that has been, I think, very well received, and hopefully will show some dividends soon.
Okay, thank you. Can we just, on this issue of social entrepreneurship, my sense is that if we want to, that a lot of the sort of spending on civil society and democracy and governance, this is often going to be a bilateral activity. This is, the U.S. government has a comparative advantage in this. In some countries in the region, it's still hard to spend money bilaterally. In Egypt is sort of the famous case where you've got to get permission slips for spending money bilaterally. There's this famous, very disagreeable woman who ran the Ministry of Cooperation who's just recently left. She's famous for being disagreeable in Washington. I'm going to have
to be worried.
Yes, yes. Well, I'm sure. Anyways, the point is, I think. And so I do think that if we want to see democracy and if we have to take the long view in democracy and governance, and we are going to have to do that on a bilateral basis. That's the role for AID. That's the role for the State Department. And so the sorts of things that we can't ask multilateral institutions to do that, we're going to have to take on that sort of political risk. And I don't see Arab philanthropy. I know a little bit about Arab philanthropy. I don't see Arab philanthropy playing the role that George Soros did in Eastern Europe. This is, you don't expect the Sawiris family or one of the other wealthy families in the region to start writing checks to supporting sort of they'll do art, they'll do education, they'll do health per se, but sort of, let's call it a democratic space. I think that's going to be something that's going to be Western allies, Eastern Europe, the European Union, but led by the United States on a bilateral basis. And this is a historic moment, and we should be flooding the zone. We should be increasing our spending on this at the expense of, we have a budget constraint, and we should be shifting our budget. And that may mean goring other people's sacred oxes within the 150 account, but my view is we should be shifting it, and this is a historic opportunity. Let me just take on the issue that sort of I'm out of government, so I'll opine. I think we in 3 minutes or less, we cut a Faustian bargain after World War II. We wanted stability for a whole slew of reasons. Both since 9/11, both President Bush and President Obama have been essentially trying to unwind that agreement slowly over time. We are running. We have a confluence of interests in the region that aren't just only democracy. Democracy is in our DNA. It's been a little bit more quiet over the last 4 years. But I think that I'd like to believe that we can renew a bipartisan focus on democracy promotion in this country. It dropped off since January the 20th, 2009. It's been very quiet. You know, I think the Arab Spring or Burma have fallen in the administration's lap. They've not been protagonists in this sort of work. Going back to what I said about social entrepreneurship, we should be flooding the zone and be putting that stuff on steroids. And to some extent, I think what's been in front of the Congress can help with that. So I do think that the administration, I think, understands that. I do think, though, that we need to be putting on the table free trade agreements with countries like Egypt. We don't have one. I disagree with some of the recommendations of how we fix some of this that the UNDP has put forward, but I think the diagnosis is perfect, and I think on the political space recommendations, I'm in complete agreement with UNDP. So I think that, yes, we do have a role. I think that also the U.S. energy revolution in this country is also going to change the calculus as well in terms of over time. So I think there's hope. We've got to take a long view of this. And I think to the extent that we have successes in countries like Tunisia and Egypt, I think there's been an overly simplistic belief in much of thinking people in the United States that for a long time pre the Arab Spring that the Arabs were never going to get democracy, that they were unsuitable for it. And I think, you know, it's one of, people won't say it in polite company, but I think that was one of the operating assumptions. It's absolutely bigoted. It's wrong. It's bigoted, and Bush and Obama both confronted it. And I think what we've seen in the Arab awakening is we need to take a very long view. They said the same things about Latin American countries or Asia, and it was totally wrong. It was bigoted and absolutely wrong. And so I think even what's happening in Egypt today, I think should give us hope that there's pushback in terms of saying, I'm not going to stand for this. So I think that you're absolutely put your finger on the absolute sort of the central question And so I think we need to take a long view. The United States absolutely has a role to play bilaterally. We should be plussing it. We need to have – and I think Hillary Clinton gets this, and I think there are voices in the administration that understand this. And so I think we have to take a long view, because if you look at the experience in Eastern Europe, that's a 20-year and still ongoing project. We need to take a long view of this. And so –